The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network. Talk to me so you can see.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Today, we're going to be taking a look at some new information that has not gone into general release yet, but it's important. And that is, how much money did the Federal Reserve actually give to the banking system? You will be absolutely flabbergasted. And I'm going to invite Professor Michael Hudson on to share his comments on this very topic of what he believes is going on when it comes to our economy. And for that matter, does he perceive any time in the near future social unrest in the United States? Many do. And we're going to be doing an entire program on that. Also today, I promise to give you some historical facts that are based upon real science showing you that you have been misled concerning the safety and efficacy of vaccines. And specifically for those of you who continue to hear those apologists and propagandists for the vaccine industry say, without the vaccines, millions would have died from smallpox or diphtheria or polio or measles or whooping cough or tuberculosis. Really? Well, we'll challenge that. Also, some brand new information that I didn't even know about, and I've been working on this for 4.5 years nonstop, on a whistleblower coming forward about the truth behind Three Mile Island. You won't want to miss this a little later on in today's program. We're rushing a crew over there. In fact, I'm flying back in the United States today. I've been out of loop in order to film this man as soon as possible and try to get him in our newest film, which is just breaking next week. Also, the latest on how Obama and the people around him in the White House have created a marriage with the genetic engineering industry. And now they're working with the White House Trade Representative and Office of Management and Budget and the EPA, all these organizations, to make sure that genetic engineering gets the front nod on all things. So that's what we're up to today. And time permitting, I'll do our issues and have your phone calls. Let's start. The latest is that the long-term use of antioxidants actually improves memory. This is published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the current issue. It says, quote, oxidative stress and pro-inflammatory states were hypothesized to play a central role in dementia and the decline of age-related cerebral functioning through lipid peroxidation. And then it went on to talk about how they used 4,447 people ages 45 to 60 in supplementation and vitamin mineral antioxidant randomized trial. And they found that by giving these people either placebo or beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, and zinc, that they were able to enhance memory and stave off dementia. So, and the amounts of vitamin C they were giving, they were small compared to what I would suggest. Vitamin E the same. So that's good news. If you're taking your antioxidants, continue taking them. I suggest about 6 times a day. Brand new research, as published in the Environmental and Experimental Biology, out of the Institute for Molecular and Cell Biology in Spain, they've discovered a new antioxidant. This new antioxidant is called FNA, and it could be available in the very near future. It's powerful. It helps prevent fats and oils from turning rancid. And it's so powerful that it's 14 times stronger than resveratrol, which is a well-known antioxidant found in red grapes and wine that helps delay cellular aging. Where did they find it? They found it in tomatoes. But not just any tomatoes, tomatoes that were stressed. It was the creation of the stress that produced a certain type of chemical reaction, and then that's where they found this completely previously unknown altogether powerful antioxidants, 10 times more potent than vitamin C. That brings me back to when I was in Bavaria, in Germany, and I was at the clinic of Dr. Joseph Issels. And in his laboratory, he had eggs, and he had these eggs that someone would physically go in and turn upside down every 2 hours. And I asked him, what are you doing that for? And he said, I'm stressing the embryo. The embryo will adapt to this stress. And therefore, when I make a solution from the egg, it will be based upon the egg's adaptogenic ability. I thought about that. And then it brought back something that happened when I first purchased my home in Florida. And the very first week, I planted some palm trees. And the next week, right after I just finished planting them, a freeze came through. The worst freeze in 60 years. Temperatures got into the mid-20s. And everything went brown. But the moment I heard that this freeze was coming, I went out and I began an aggressive fertilization program. I fertilized them 3 times a day, putting a fish emulsion fertilizer around the plants, and did so every day thereafter for a month. Well, about a month later, this truck comes down and they're cutting out all the dead trees, and virtually every tree on our block was dead. So I said, no. I said, these will come back to life. And the guy says, they're not coming back. All these trees are dead. I said, it may look dead, but it's not. Well, sure enough, the following year, and it took an entire year, new buds came up out of the top of the trees. And the lesson was this. When something is stressed in nature, if it adapts and is able to survive, it has the memory of what it was stressed to, and also has the memory, an epigenetic memory, of how it can exceed the limitations. It's no different than how a plant creates a natural insecticide or a natural sunscreen or a natural herbicide. All of this it does on its own. And that's why certain plants you want to have in your garden, because they're natural insecticide, like ryegrass. Ryegrass, planted in the aisles, gives you a nice, beautiful lawn, and the rye grows 12 months a year, and especially is green in the wintertime when everything else is brown, like bahia and timothy grass and St. Augustine grass. It's all green, brown in the winter, greens up in the summer. It doesn't, but it has a natural insecticide. And people ask, well, Jeebus, why aren't your crops all destroyed by insects? Because they use natural insecticides. And then when you have a plant that comes back from a very challenged position, nearly freezing, you frequently find that it gives you an abundance of fruit after that. It's much like a tree cutting. I have some orange trees, plum trees, and kiwis that are 25, 30 feet high. I cut them down to 8 feet. And initially, everything goes off the trees, but I aggressively fertilize it. And then, lo and behold, in 2 months, back come the leaves. Now you get fruit that you can actually pick. When it gets too high, you can't pick it, but also it gets more dense. So this goes into this whole idea that the tomato, when stressed, creates survival antioxidants that are stronger than vitamin C by a factor of 10 times more or 1,000% more. And that's also true in many other areas of life. It's also true with human beings who have survived really bad situations. If they choose, they can not only be stronger because of that, because the memory of what they experienced and the memory of how they exceeded that are locked in their genes. Now they can use it constructively as a positive lesson in life. So a new antioxidant, and just the initials coming your way, FNA, in the very near future. Now, for those of you who've wondered, gee whiz, is ozone that beneficial? We hear so many people who've been treated for so many conditions that have improved. We're just finishing this week a review of the entire world literature on ozone. We have over 7,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature. This is just one from the National Library of Medicine, the public government's official repository of medical literature. and this is in PubMed, it says, use of dissolved ozone in the treatment of experimental tuberculosis. And it goes on to talk about how the ozone was able to kill off the tuberculosis, where the medication was not. That's just one study. So imagine people who have tuberculosis in Haiti, in refugee camps throughout the world, where tuberculosis is endemic. It is so inexpensive. It's just O3. It just has an extra molecule of oxygen. It's easy to use. And for the people who have tuberculosis, it could help kill the tuberculosis and keep it from spreading. So my suggestion is to those individuals who are at the UN who listen to this program, and I know there are many because I see their emails, suggest putting ozone into the medical treatment program in those refugee camps. And also for the people working down in Haiti, I would do the same thing. Also, drug-related morbidity and mortality has been estimated to cost more than $136 billion a year. In fact, that's more than the total cost of cardiovascular care and diabetes care combined in the United States. And yet, according to an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association by six different MDs and PhDs, nothing has changed. Nothing is being done about it. So the next time someone tells you, gee whiz, there's a lot of money that we should be cutting back in Medicare and Medicaid, I disagree. Some improvements, yes, for fraud prevention, but we shouldn't be cutting back. I believe we should have one universal health care, and I'm going to deal with that tomorrow. The lies that those on the right or the bulldog Democrats on the left put out saying, oh, we don't want to follow England or Canada's program. You take forever to get treatment, and it's not good. All lies. I'll go into details. But then I want to know, what are the primary causes for people dying each year in the United States? And I went through the list. Heart disease, cancer, stroke, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, accidents, pneumonia, influenza, diabetes, suicide, nephritis, chronic liver disease, and cirrhosis. And those represented your top causes of disease. Interesting what's missing there, AIDS. And yet AIDS gets more money spent on it than any two of those combined. That's the politics. That's the smart people who knew how to milk a system. More on that later. So my question is this. Should we not be advocating for a preventative health program in the United States, not influence or any input from the fast food industries, the people who would normally be selected, and all the people in the field who actually have experience preventing disease or reversing disease naturally, because right there we could be saving at least $150 billion a year. That's a lot to save. And we'd be getting people healthier, and that would also mean they'd be using less meds, and that would save them personally. So it would just have an altogether good effect. So more on that coming up. But just to let you know that they say, well, where there's a problem, there's a solution. There's the problem. We have the solution, but the government does not. This comes from Joe Palermo, and it says, Gary, I heard your comment with regards to cell towers. I'm an engineer working in broadband communications for over 20 years. In the past, I have worked for Bell Labs, both Lucent and AT&T. The problem is that the technology now allows for wireless providers such as AT&T and Verizon Sprint to place their transmitters not on cell towers, but on buildings, much closer to people. The equipment allows for a fiber optic link from the base station to the actual transmitter. With a fiber optic link, you now have the ability to transmit the data over a much longer distance. So the wireless providers have a central point where data is aggregated, then sent to the antenna where the power amp resides. The transmitter does not have to be on a tower, but on the side or on top of a building. And so why I thought this was important is because a lot of people are not aware that it's not just the cell phone they're using, it's the tower that's taking the information off the satellite and then relaying it from the satellite to the tower to your cell phones. that's emanating a lot of electromagnetic pulses. And you wouldn't want to live in a building or near a building that had one of those towers. The question is, are you even aware that there are those towers? They're not that big, and they're easily disguised. So you should take a look at the buildings around you. Go up on the roof and look around to see, are there towers? And then I would get as much information as possible. We have a lot on our website to challenge the use of those on a building, because it could be causing you all kinds of problems. And a comment from Ralph Nader. As you know, I'm always suggesting take your money out of the major banks and put it into credit unions or small just savings banks. Here's what Nader says about this from commondreams.org. While the reckless giant banks are shattering like an overheated glacier day by day, the nation's credit unions are relatively Isle of Calm, largely apart from the vortex of casino capitalism. 85 million Americans belong to credit unions, which are not-for-profit cooperatives owned by their members, who are depositors and borrowers. Your neighborhood or workplace credit union did not invest in those notorious speculative derivatives, nor did they offer people teaser rates to sign on for a home mortgage they could not afford. 91% of the 88,000 credit unions are reporting greater overall growth in mortgage lending than any other kind of consumer loans they are extending. They are federally issued by the National Credit Union Administration for up to $250,000 per account, such as the FDIC does for depositors in commercial banks. They are well capitalized because of regulation and because they do not have an incentive to go for high-risk, high-leverage speculation to increase stock values and the value of the boss's stock options, as do the commercial banks. Credit unions have no shareholders, nor stock, nor stock options. They're responsible to their owner members, who are their customers. There are even some special low-income credit unions, but not nearly enough to stimulate economic activities in these communities and to provide banking services in areas where poor people can't afford or are not provided services by commercial banks. According to Mike Schenck, an economist with Credit Union National Association, there's another reason why credit unions avoided the mortgage debacle that is consuming the big banks. Credit unions, he says, are portfolio lenders. That means they hold in their portfolios most of the loans they originate instead of selling them to investors, so they care about the financial performance of those loans. Mr. Schenck allowed that with the deepening recession, credit unions are not making as much surplus and their asset quality has deteriorated a bit, but that's the beauty of the credit union model. Credit unions can give with those conditions without suffering dire consequences. So, once again, take your money out of the big banks, put it in the small banks. It'd be a much better way to go. And optimism appears to lower women's risk of death and heart disease. This is a new study out. It says three things. Optimistic women have a lower risk of developing heart disease and dying than pessimistic women. Pessimistic African-American women in particular had higher rates of dying from all causes. Researchers say it's unclear if interventions to change attitudes can alter risk. And this was published in the Circulation, the Journal of the American Heart Association. So the idea is, are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? If you're optimistic, you just added a whole new direction in keeping yourself healthier longer. And also, why you may lose that loving feeling after tying the knot. And I thought this was interesting in our human nature segment. This is from Northwestern University, and I'll quote it. Dating couples whose dreams include marriage would do well to step back and reflect upon the type of support they'll need from their partners when they cross the threshold. Will the partner who supports your hopes and aspirations while you are dating also help you fulfill important responsibilities and obligations that come with marriage? The answer to that question can make a difference in how satisfied you are after tying the knot. Believing a partner is there to help you grow into the person you aspire to be, predicated based upon a higher relationship satisfaction for both dating and married couples, the study showed. But the belief that your partner helps you live up to your responsibilities and uphold your commitments only predicted higher relationship satisfaction after marriage. For dating couples, the relationship itself tends to revolve around whether things are moving forward. Happiness with a partner depends upon whether the relationship will grow into something more, whether a partner will support the dreams the other eventually hopes to achieve. For married couples, the feeling that their partners are helping them to advance their relationships and realize their ideal achievements is still important. But the relationships of married couples, now more interconnected both practically and psychologically, tend to revolve around upholding the commitment made to their partners. Unlike dating couples, married couples also put a high premium on their partner's support of whatever they determine to be necessary obligations. In other words, the feelings of being loved and supported that people use to judge who makes a good girlfriend or boyfriend may not be completely trustworthy in deciding who makes a good husband or wife, unquote from the professor who ran the study. Those feelings may only be partially captured, only partially capture the emotion that will determine your satisfaction with the person you marry. Now, here are my thoughts on that. I believe that this is an extremely short-sighted review. First off, how many people, when dating, are thinking of, gee whiz, what will this person in this relationship do for me to help me advance my goals and help me feel better about myself and help give me the support I otherwise wouldn't have once we're married? They have to do it every day, 7 days a week. You can't take a holiday from this. You can't be nice some of the time and not nice some of the time. You can't say nice things and unnice things. The expectation is that you have to be this kind of perfect model of a person. Or you accept that after marriage, you can argue all you want because the passion, the life, the force is somehow diminished. Because who's going to continue now that the biggest challenge was getting someone into your life where you now have some security? That security, financial security, emotional security, physical security and comfort, that is the single most important reason people are coupled. And then, of course, you never pull back far enough to see, why are you really in this relationship? What is the purpose of this relationship? And each generation has a different modus operandi for being in a relationship. Today, the younger people more and more are saying no to marriage because they don't want to be obligated and having to be the missing piece of another person's puzzle life, and then going through all the torturous arguments and accusing and rationalization and justification and apologizing and living with this sense of apprehension of, did I say the right thing? Did I do the right thing? Did I miss something? Because there's recriminations. When you're dating, those kind of recriminations generally get you someone saying goodbye. When you're married, it's not. It's, you know, this is what marriage is. Do you think it was going to be fun and roses and happy? No. As if this, somehow we've just gotten into ourselves a really challenging situation. Now, that doesn't mean that that's always the way it is, but this whole idea from this study is that before you marry someone, when you're in a relationship, ask, what do you expect this person to be different once you're married? Do you expect them to really be there all the time and to be your cheerleader, to be your supporter? Because it's not going to happen. So think about that. And so unless they leave out of the equation how a lot of people are motivated until they achieve something, and then that motivation is gone. The growth stops. The passion stops. The dressing up stops. The taking care of yourself stops. They let themselves go. We're not honest about that in our society, and we should be. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. In about around 8 minutes now, we'll be talking with Michael Hudson concerning some new information about who got what and why we weren't told about it, and what does he think is going to be happening based upon our current economic realities. A quick special for us. This special, eye care, natural maxi eye care. This is a formula I put together, and it has all the ingredients that you would expect and more that would make a difference. You're getting the best alpha lipoic acid and lutein and lycopene and xanthan and vitamin C and carotenoids. You're getting everything that I believe is important for the eye. And I haven't had this on special in over a year. Here's the deal. This is phenomenal. You're going to buy one jar. It's only $30. I'm going to give you one free. Plus, I'm going to give you a free $40 video, Natural Approaches to Eye Care. Everything you need to know about macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma, and everything about caring for the eye by some of the leading holistic ophthalmologists. This full documentary, which you haven't offered, Natural Eye Care, $40 free. So you're getting a $90.83 value for just $30. You're saving $60.41. This is today only. The number to call to get this is 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. A phenomenal deal for you. And it's called Maxi Eye Care, my own all-natural eye care formula. Let's go into our studio in New York City and say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Gary. We have a lovely email here from Sam and his sister. Sam lives in the Bronx. He's a truck driver. He's been following the show now for over 18 years. He's now healthy, but he used to have diabetes actually for his whole adult life, but when he took a protocol, it was gone within 6 months. He had a gut, he was holding a gut, but he's been working out, and within a year, it's now gone. He's never felt healthier. He says that he was on a call with his sister. She's just turned 35. She is competing in the World Games, the Masters, and about 5 weeks ago now at the US National Championships, she was waiting to do the competition, and the gun went off. The athletes started bolting around the track, and she saw a man who looked too young to be in the competition, and at about 2 laps to go, he came sprinting forward, and he beat all the other athletes. She said that when she realized who it was, and it was you, she introduced herself to you, and she said to her brother that you looked as though you had about 2 to 3% of body fat. You were absolutely ripped. And how had you gone from the end of the race to right at the front to win it? She said she was really inspired, and so she went online and went onto YouTube to see one of your videos on fitness, and she's been really inspired. She says that it's really good to see somebody who's devoted themselves to health, who has the body of a 12-year-old, flowing around the track, and so she's wasn't at all interested in exercising, but now she is, and she's really into the Masters, competing for it. She's looking forward to learning more. One thing that came out of this is very nice, and people look at, say, Keith Overman on television, for example, or others who are on the radio, and we look at how they don't take care of themselves. But then when you go to your videos and your bios, it's all recent stuff. You still have the body of a 20-year-old. You look absolutely brilliant. And a question out of this is, why do people just give up on themselves physically, please? And why is it that they just stop caring about their bodies?
I don't believe that they have any intention to stop caring. It depends upon what their goals are. For example, with Keith Oberman, he spends a great deal of time studying his subject matter, and he's very competent at it. He has written some of the most brilliant and illuminating commentaries that I've heard, especially when Bush was in office, and he was every single night doing something called Bush, which showed some of the bad policies of Bush, and he was really searing in that. When you get to a certain level of acceptance, when you have a television show and a best-selling author, and you're in demand. You have been accepted within the official field as someone to be listened to. There is very often this idea that you have arrived. You don't have to do anything more. And that's when, in effect, we graduate. Every study has shown that when people graduate from college, they rarely read a book after that, and almost never in the general fields. They might read something pertaining to their work, but they don't read very much. Americans don't read after that. There was a time when people did read because there was very few other sources of information, and they were very articulate, and they studied other languages, not uncommon at all. In fact, one of the best ways of appreciating this is to read some of the letters that were written home from the soldiers in the Civil War. You would be hard put to find 20 people who could write such elegant letters today who are the same age as many of those who were fighting at that time.
Right.
If you wake up each day and you live your life in balance, then you must put time and energy into everything that is a part of that balance. So if your health is important, then you have to eat right, you have to exercise, and you have to deal with stress as it occurs in all of us every day. That's a part of the balance. If you also are living as a spiritual being, then there's a certain amount of time and energy each day that you must put into helping others without thought of what you will receive in return. You do it simply because being kind to others is acknowledging your spiritual reality. If intellectual growth is important, then you will set time aside each day to read and to study, not that which you're familiar with, but that which you're not, so you're starting at the beginning of a learning curve to grow in ways you would otherwise not. And the same with our relationships. If a relationship is important to you, then you must give quality time to that relationship, making it as creative, exciting, pleasurable as possible. And now look at the world we live in. When you become successful or you're striving for some form of security or success, almost all of your energy goes into that single-mindedness. And everything else is left to when you hope you have the time in the future. But it never happens. What does happen is we become imbalanced. So the person who achieves so much one day ends up with prostate cancer or breast cancer, or a stroke, or a heart attack, or bankruptcy, or someone says goodbye, I'm not waiting any longer before you realize that I'm also a part of this relationship. That is what we have to understand. In effect, Elizabeth, everything you do in life mirrors you. So then what are the lessons of your choices and their outcomes? If everything you do, everything you choose mirrors a need, then what needs are you trying to satisfy? How do your beliefs influence your choices? If you're insecure, almost all your choices will be based upon doing something that makes you feel more secure, whether you are or not. That's where your energy is going to go. So if you start with feeling very secure and very full of life, then you're not going to overcompensate. The person who is incomplete, empty, the person who feels depressed and angst, ridden will be the person that imbalances themselves. They'll put too much energy into a relationship and always too intense. They'll put too much into their work and always too intense. Whatever they do, they will overdo it. They will overcompensate. And that's because when they look in the mirror, they don't see the same image that they're projecting out to the rest of the world. They see the imperfections. They see the limitations. They see that which they would not find acceptable. So in order for the rest of the world not to see that, they have to overdo it, hoping that when they finally make it, that everyone will look at them in the right way. But it never happens. So I'm a great believer that we should put time aside to train, to live our life as if each piece of our life was essential. Hope that answers the question.
That's great. Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. My guest is on hold. We're going to go over and say hello to him now. He has been on many times. He is Professor Michael Hudson. And Michael Hudson has been an economist for many different governmental agencies. He is a developer of the Hudson Institute. He has worked with the White House, State, and Defense Departments. He was the economic political advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich's 2008 presidential campaign. And he is an author. He has written Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order, as well as Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of the American Empire. And also, I won't go into it in any depth. I don't want to embarrass him, but he goes all over the world all the time counseling presidents and prime ministers and governments about what is coming and therefore how, in the most positive way, to position themselves so they can thrive and survive. Nice to have you back with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary.
I want to open by sharing this, that I just received this morning. This is by Senator Bernie Sanders, who you're familiar with. I'm going to quote this because this I didn't know about. Quote, "The first top-to-bottom audit of the Federal Reserve uncovered eye-popping new details about how the U.S. provided a whopping $16 trillion in secret loans to bail out American and foreign banks and businesses during the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression." Senator Bernie Sanders, of course, got this information because he included an amendment to the Wall Street Reform Law passed a year ago this week, directing the Government Accounting Office to conduct a study. Quote, "As a result of this audit, we now know that the Federal Reserve provided more than $16 trillion in total financial assistance to some of the largest financial institutions, corporations in the United States and throughout the world. This is a clear case of socialism for the rich and rigged. You're on your own, individualism for everyone else," unquote. Now, among the investigation's key findings is that the Fed unilaterally provided trillions of dollars in financial assistance to foreign banks, South Korea, Scotland. Quote, "No agency of the United States government should be allowed to bail out a foreign bank or a corporation without the direct approval of Congress and the President," unquote. This wasn't done. Now, we're not talking now about TARP, the $747 billion, and we're not talking about quantitative easing. We're talking about another secret $16 trillion of money given out. This is just mind-numbing, and it's J.P. Morgan got this money, and all these major corporations got this money, but the American public didn't get a dime. Small businesses didn't get a dime. Your thoughts on this, please?
Well, all of the details are published on the senator's website in a 250-page report. At the time, many congressmen, after September 2008, were asking for the details of the Fed. The Fed would say that it was going to provide credit for whatever it was needed to save the economy. When the Fed says the economy, that meant the companies for which the Federal Reserve's heads in New York work for. So the Federal Reserve mainly gave the money to their own companies. That's the real scandal in what Bernie Sanders said. Not that it's to foreign banks, which borrowed the money mainly to repay other U.S. banks, but the fact that the people on the Fed who were in charge of the committee were people from J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and smaller squids on Wall Street. And they basically gave the money to themselves. Much of this has been repaid, but the report that Senator Sanders asked for only goes through a year ago, so that we can't really see how much is still open. Basically, these were the cash for trash loans. There would have been an obligation for the Wall Street firms to sell these loans or borrow against them on the market, they could have got only about 22 cents per dollar. So the Fed, by supporting a free market, paid five times what the real market price was. The giveaway was not merely the $16 trillion, but the fact that the government, the companies, the banks that got this money, then recycled much of it back to Washington to contribute to the Democratic congressmen and Republican congressmen to buy influence through the lobbying groups and use this money really to gain control of the American political process and to campaign to make sure that the government dismantled any regulatory plans that it had to make sure that, for instance, Wall Street's factotum in Washington, President Obama, would not appoint Elizabeth Warren. And they used the money very largely to push for putting the class war back in business in a way that it hasn't been in really a century, favoring Wall Street over the rest of the economy. There was a huge bailout, and as you say, businesses didn't get them. Insolvent homeowners didn't get them. The only people that were bailed out were the wealthiest 10% at the very top of the economic pyramid.
Last evening, in another country, I was watching a report from a, I think his name was Orlov. He was a Russian.
He's in New York now. He's an American now.
Oh, he is.
He came here a few years ago.
And he was talking about how he sees only more greed and more control of more money and assets, and that they're on a blinding feeding frenzy. I don't want to misquote him, but he said something to the effect that once they saw how easy it was to lie to the American public and how easy it was to get any amount of money they wanted and get rid of their toxic assets and still have the ability to borrow money at zero interest and create enormous debt and buy companies and everything they were doing, now the floodgates are open. They don't want to leave anything on the table. And he said that the American public is the most passive he has seen in the world as a people who are being completely exploited, with the wealthiest one half of 1% having more wealth in the bottom 40%. But he said this. He said he sees coming in the near future a battle. And he believes that this battle will be violent. He does not believe it will be like in the Middle East, where there will just be protests in the streets or in other places. He said that this, he said, is going to happen here. Now, I've heard a lot of people, yourself, also say that we believe that there will be some form of pushback. Could you tell us your thoughts, since you're all over the world, and you've seen the pushback in other countries at the government level? Give us your larger view, please. Talk to us about what you see happening in Ireland. I realize you're projecting, and it's subjective, but you've been accurate each time you've been on. Talk about the other parts of the world, and then end up with what you see happening here in the United States.
Well, if you really want to take the long view, throughout most of history, it's always been the wealthy and the what you'd call the right wing of the spectrum that's been violent, not the left. You can go back to Rome. In Roman history, in 133 B.C., was at a point very much like today. There was a fight between the Gracchi brothers, who were leading the creditor interests against the debtor interests against the creditors, and the creditors, the right wingers in Rome, in the Senate, simply murdered the left wingers. They pushed them all off the cliff. And there then was 100 years of civil war, and the right wing won. In Europe, it's basically the right wing, as we've seen in Norway, that are the terrorists. People who want to grab for themselves, and the people that you call the greedy, are the most willing to be violent to defend themselves. Where people who are not greedy, who want to share, tend to be the least violent people. The protests in Europe have not been violent, except for the police agent provocateurs among their ranks. They've in Greece, they went out and demonstrated, largely to show that the democracy was not behind the government privatization, and that legally meant that if a government commits to pay debts without the agreement of its population, the debts don't have to be paid. Same thing in Iceland and Latvia, where in the middle of January, 2 years ago, there were big pots and pan demonstrations in Iceland and protests in Latvia against the cuts, But these were peaceful cuts. The violence is almost always from the right. And in the United States, the reason that you're having a right-wing Republican position being pushed by the Democrats is precisely because only a Democratic president could get away with doing what Mr. Obama is doing today, which is trying to roll back Social Security, roll back Medicare, roll back Medicaid and government spending. If the Republicans would have tried to do this, the Democratic Congress would have fought against it. But when a Democratic president does this, the Democratic congressmen are paralyzed. They don't know what to do. And so the threat of violence and demonstrations here is being muted by the fact that here the leaders of the Democratic Party are leading the movement to the right. It's not the Republicans that wanted to go against Social Security. It's Obama that really believes in trickle-down economics and wants to roll back Social Security. And that's why he appointed the Deficit Reduction Commission that he did, pushing for reductions in Social Security. That's why he appointed Republicans to the committee, along with Blue Dog Democrats, the Committee of Six that's supposed to write the legislation to get rid of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and as we know it. You needed a Democratic president to do this, and this makes it very hard for people to revolt. They did in Wisconsin against a Republican governor who was directly threatening their employment and unionization. So what Wall Street's found is that if they can get the Democrats to do here what the Labour Party in London did, which is deliver their constituency to the financial interest, then there's not going to be much of a protest.
So you don't see any form of social or class demonstrations in the United States?
The demonstrations have to be organized, and who's going to organize it? I don't see the Democrats organizing demonstrations, and the evidence for this is that they haven't even proposed a dump Obama movement. They haven't even proposed an alternative because they know that he has it sewn up, and the Republicans are helping avoid any kind of a confrontation by stepping aside and by pushing such a sort of crazy right-wing agenda that it makes Obama look rational and sane and on the side of the people by comparison. So what we're seeing is a kind of staged melodrama, sort of like a World Wrestling Foundation wrestling match where you're trying to get the people all on the side of someone who seems like they should be the winner. And it's all staged. And apparently it's working on most people.
Final question. Do you see the other world economies that are doing better, such as Brazil and South Africa and China and India, the BRICS nations, do you see them at any point in the next 2 to 3 years shifting from the dollar as a reserve currency to their own mixed currencies?
That's what they're trying to do. That's why they had the meeting in Yekaterinburg, Russia, a year ago, and that's why they just met in China explicitly to develop an alternative. They're trying to avoid using the dollar and the euro altogether, and so far what they're doing is setting up barter deals, just like in the 1950s. To avoid using the dollar, and setting up swap deals among themselves. So, yes, the rest of the world, apart from Europe and America, are trying to avoid the dollar because they realize that supporting the dollar really means providing the United States with enough foreign exchange to extend its military bases throughout the world. And the BRICS countries are trying to demilitarize the globe. And the way they're doing it is cutting off the financial taproot of militarism.
Well, of course, when they do shift over to a mixed currency, that's going to have an impact upon the dollar and the value of dollars.
It'll push up raw materials, it'll push up the price of imports, and it will cut into living standards. And the Democrats are doing, or people like Paul Krugman, are blaming China and blaming the foreigners. And yet what the BRIC countries and China are doing is exactly following the path that America got rich by having a mixed economy where the government invests in infrastructure to keep the prices low, instead of privatizing and making a free-for-all like you'd have, for instance, in Mexico with the telephone system that's the highest priced in the world. So they're doing, the irony is that the BRICS countries are now following the policy that made America rich and the policy that used to be the progressive era's reform plan that led to the New Deal. While America's moving way to the right and is retrogressing back towards the Gilded Age of the 19th century.
Michael Hudson, thank you very much. I always appreciate you coming in and giving some clarity to these issues.
Well, thank you very much, Gary.
MichaelHudson.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, here's some insight into how to try to make sense of all that loans that the Federal Reserve gave to the banks. Now we know how much they gave, $16 trillion all in secret.
Did you hear about the bailouts?
No, what about the bailouts?
The governments have announced the taxpayers will make money on the bailouts.
Should I believe them?
Depends. Do you believe the politicians are honest?
No.
Do you believe the bankers are fair?
No.
Do you believe that the 2 plus 2 equals pink?
No. I definitely do not believe that the 2 plus 2 equals pink.
Then you should not believe we'll make money on the bailouts.
But how could the governments claim such a thing?
By conveniently ignoring the backdoor bailouts.
What is a backdoor bailout?
A backdoor bailout is like any other bailout, except the governments lie and say it wasn't a bailout.
But what was the main bailout?
The main bailout was the TARP program.
What is the TARP program?
A program where the governments used the taxpayer dollars to buy the shares in the banks.
Why did they buy the shares?
Because they said the banks were too big to fail, and if they failed, there would be too many foreclosures and no new mortgages.
So after the governments bought the shares, did the banks stop the foreclosures?
No.
Did they give the mortgages?
No.
So what did they do with the money?
They used it to buy other banks.
But weren't they already too big to fail?
Yes.
So now they are too bigger to fail?
Exactly.
Which banks are too bigger to fail?
The biggest are the J.P. Morgan Chase, Bear Stearns, Washington Mutual, and the Bank of America Countrywide Merrill Lynch.
What about the Goldman Sachs? Did they buy another bank?
No.
Why not?
Because when you already own the U.S. government, you don't need to buy any more banks.
After the other banks became too big or to fail, did they stop the foreclosures?
No.
Did they give the mortgages?
No.
Did they do anything at all?
One executive at the Bank of America Countrywide, Merrill Lynch, paid the bill on his $70,000 desk.
My God, is this a corrupt third world country?
Definitely not.
How could you be so sure?
Because nobody in a third world country would be stupid enough to spend $70,000 on a desk.
Is this executive still at the Bank of America Countrywide, Merrill Lynch?
No, he is now the CEO of the CIT.
What is the CIT?
The CIT is a failed lending company.
How could a failed company hire a new CEO?
Because they also got billions in the bailouts.
Do these people have no shame?
When you constantly get the bailouts, you don't care about the shame.
What was the main backdoor bailout?
The biggest was the bailout of the AIGs.
Why did they bail out the AIGs?
Because the AIGs had borrowed billions from the banks, and if they went under, the banks would lose too much money.
And after the bailout, how much did the banks lose?
Nothing.
How is that possible?
Because the governments decided the taxpayers should pay for all the banks' mistakes.
Which bank did the AIGs owe the most money to?
The Goldman Sachs.
So despite its poor decision to lend too much money to a failed company, the Goldman Sachs did not lose a penny?
Actually, the Goldman Sachs probably profited from the failure of the AIGs.
How could someone profit from the downfall of one of their biggest clients?
Because while the Goldman Sachs was lending money to the AIGs, it was also making a secret bet that they would go under.
My God, is this some kind of science fiction movie, like the Star Wars?
No.
How do you know?
Because the evil empire in the Star Wars was fiction, but the evil empire, that is the Goldman Sachs, is very real.
But were the American people outraged by this manipulation?
At the time, the American people did not know about the structure of this bailout.
How come?
Because the governments ordered the AIGs to lie to the people.
Who in the governments gave such an order?
The New York Fed.
And who at the time was in charge of the New York Fed?
The Timothy Geithner.
And who put the Timothy Geithner in charge?
The Timothy Geithner was appointed by the President Bush.
What about the President Obama and the change? Did the President Obama bring the change to the Timothy Geithner?
Yes.
So he fired him?
No, he promoted him to Treasury Secretary.
That does not sound like the change we can believe in.
Definitely not.
Were there any other bailouts?
Yes, during the financial crisis, the Ben Bernanke loaned trillions of dollars to companies like the Barclays.
What is the Barclays?
The Barclays is a European bank.
Why would the Ben Bernanke lend money to a European bank?
So they could buy the Lehman after it went bankrupt.
And why did the Lehman go bankrupt?
Because the Ben Bernanke refused to lend them any money.
But why would the Fed refuse to lend the American people's money to an American bank, but then lend the money to a European bank?
I don't know, maybe because the Europeans have funny accents.
But me and you also have funny accents, so the Ben Bernanke lend us money?
No.
Why not?
Because we are not bankers, and to the Ben Bernanke, if you are not a banker, then you simply don't exist.
So after all these bailouts, did the banks stop the foreclosures?
No.
Did they give the mortgages?
No.
Did they do anything at all?
They paid themselves big bonuses.
That does not sound like a prudent use of the American people's money.
When you constantly get the bailouts, you don't care about the prudence.
Are any of the bailouts going on today?
Yes, the Ben Bernanke keeps the short-term interest rates at zero.
How is that a bailout?
Low rates mean the banks have to pay the American people very little interest in their savings accounts.
That is a very nice gift from the American people to the banks.
Yes.
And to show their gratitude, did the banks stop the foreclosures?
No.
Did they give the mortgages?
No.
Did they do anything at all?
Yes, they increased the monthly fees on all bank accounts.
That does not sound like the gratitude, that sounds like the screwing of the American people.
Yes.
But isn't it normally a bad idea to screw your own customers?
When you constantly get the bailouts, you don't care about your customers.
But after all these different bailouts, what do the banks do with the money?
They invested a lot of it in the foreign countries.
Why did they invest in the foreign countries?
Because they said in America the taxes are too high.
Why are the taxes so high?
Because the government is broke.
And why is the government broke?
Because they spent all their money on the bailouts.
Is this all some kind of a sick joke?
Yes, in a way, it is.
What kind of joke is it?
Well, do you work for a bank?
No.
Did you get any of the bailouts?
No.
Do you pay income taxes?
Yes.
Then the joke is on you.
That's an understatement. Just consider this, the largest theft, the largest misappropriation, the largest fraud, the largest Ponzi scheme, the largest pyramid scheme in world history has occurred in the last 2 years under Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve, and I don't hear a thing on the left or the right. And that's unfortunate. I'm Gary Nall. We're up at the end of our program. Later today, 7 o'clock tonight, continuing with the Progressive Commentary Hour, I'll be doing a commentary on the startling revelations about Three Mile Island disaster. Everything you were told is a lie. We'll have a whistleblower discussing that who was there. Historic facts exposing the dangers and ineffectiveness of vaccines in depth. I will also be doing commentaries on such topics as 9/11. Who really benefited from 9/11? Then James Ridgway, mass psychosis in the United States, how Big Pharma got Americans hooked on antipsychotic drugs. Then from David DeGraw, austerity and deficit hawks say, let them eat cake. The people say, no, but he believes people are going to go to the street and there'll be urban warfare. Will there be? From Sarah Jaffe, the unemployed aren't invisible. Washington and the media just aren't paying attention. And finally, from Frank Schaefer, who was my guest last week, Christian Jihad. Why should we worry about right-wing terror attacks like Norway's in the United States? Or should we? A lot to talk about, a lot of important commentaries you're not going to hear anywhere else. Join me tonight, 7 p.m., Progressive Radio Network for Progressive Commentary. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening.